The third case for oral argument this morning is Monty Truman and others who are the appellants versus Darren Grease and others who are the appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons and Mr. Russell Janklow, attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Parsons, I understand you'll be speaking this morning.
Yes, sir.
All right. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Jeffrey Connolly and Mr. Chris Palmer, attorneys from Rapid City. And Mr. Connolly, I understand you'll be speaking today, is that correct? All right. Both sides. My understanding is counsel have agreed that Mr. Parsons' chart may be used by both sides, and nobody's got a problem with that. Okay. With that, then, Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, following Mr. Palmer. I would, as a proposition, respectfully suggest initially that this Court's jurisprudence surrounding the doctrine of sovereign immunity over the last 50 or 60 years has not always been a model of consistency. And it's therefore been difficult, I think, for courts over the last several decades to synthesize the standards into principles that can be objectively and predictably applied. I think to its great credit, this Court in recent years has been steadily moving towards a unified theory of sovereign immunity in decisions such as Hansen and Wolf and King and Unruh most recently. My hope is that the unique facts of this case will provide the Court an opportunity to seize that will provide the missing piece of the puzzle in providing a predictable and accurate standard for sovereign immunity determinations based on the discretionary and ministerial dichotomy. My concern is that the Bickner decision that just came down might be mistakenly construed by lower courts as a step backward in the process. And I'd like to speak directly to Bickner, but if I may, I'd first like to make just a few observations about Unruh, which I think is a very significant decision. In Unruh, this Court cleared a lot of the brush, I think, away from the issue and made clear, it started, of course, with first principles and talked about the doctrine of sovereign immunity having its roots in English common law. The U.S. Constitution, of course, then preserves that for the states. And then Unruh focused on the South Dakota Constitution, which directs that the legislature shall essentially direct how that doctrine will be applied in the South Dakota courts. And as this Court explained, sovereign immunity protects the state unless it has consented to be sued. But that consent is, I think, as Unruh acknowledges and as Justice Zinner also emphasized in his concurrence, is in large part directly controlled by the legislature. And so, with regard to the situation of insurance, and in this case, a slightly different situation, the People Fund, the state essentially has what may be unchecked control regarding what is and what is not covered by the doctrine of sovereign immunity. And I think that's significant in this case. In Unruh, the Court recognized, of course, that SCCL 2132A2 provides a waiver of sovereign immunity. And that statute also says that it will be an affirmative defense that is not a bar to pleading, but is rather something that the state must raise and prove under the evidence in a particular case. And the People Fund creates the risk-sharing pool, or the People Fund statutes are the risk-sharing pool that waives sovereign immunity. And so, to a large degree, the People Fund memorandum is what governs the sovereign immunity determination in this case. I think it's fair to say. That People's Fund memorandum is in the record in this case, and it states that the exclusions do not apply if the damages are the result of a ministerial act or task. And so I think the People Fund memorandum provides the framework that at least the Court begins with in determining what is and who is not covered by sovereign immunity. So then you go to the statute. And the statute says that the public board or officer whose duty it is to repair or maintain any public highway shall erect and maintain at points in conformity with standard uniform practices at any sharp turn, blind crossing, or point of danger on such highway a substantial and conspicuous warning sign.
What is a point of danger?
I think a point of danger is something that is known to cause injury.
So no. Could that be a snow-covered road?
I think if it is something that the officer knows that is a threat, a direct threat to life and limb.
So every road in South Dakota in the winter could be a point of danger then?
It could be a point of danger.
So what, there should be a sign then? There shall be a sign saying, beware of snow-covered roads?
Well, no, I think the statute assumes that you're talking about something that has permanence.
Well, snow is pretty permanent in South Dakota in the winter, isn't it?
It is. I think that the hazard would have to be removed and the snow would have to be cleared, or there would have to be something erected to prevent people from driving right
so
into
if
it.
So if we go with your theory that there has to be a sign at every point of danger, line crossing, sharp curve, are we not putting South Dakota in the position of being named a defendant in almost every single automobile accident lawsuit in this state?
I don't think so. I think that it would depend on the evidence. And that's always the case under this statute. I mean, what you're talking about is liability. There's a distinction between liability and sovereign immunity. And it's settled law, I think, in this court under Fritz and Braun that this statute does create a duty of care that is actionable. I mean, Fritz says it's a jury question.
Right, when it's a ministerial duty, but I guess what we're talking here about is discretionary. Where does the state officer who's in charge of putting up these signs say, where does it say this constitutes a point of danger? What's the standard that says this is a point of danger, this is a sharp curve? What kind of an angle is a sharp curve? Otherwise, aren't you going to have a situation where the decision about what constitutes a point of danger or what constitutes a sharp curve, et cetera, is going to be made by each individual different jury that hears the case?
I don't think that's true necessarily. I think in some cases, I mean, I think the burden of proof is high to establish that that the duty was violated. And regarding to a point of danger, I think it has to be something that's known. I think it has to be something that's unremedied and known to the state.
Would the hole in the road in Hanson been a point of danger?
I think the evidence didn't establish that.
She drove her car in, the car was damaged, and she was hurt.
The evidence didn't establish that the officer in charge was on notice of that, that the state had the opportunity to do something about it. I think if the state knows that there's a crater in the highway and chooses not to do anything about it, then I think the statute would be implicated. And I think that is a jury question.
So there really isn't any sovereign immunity anymore because you're going to get to a jury no matter what on a fact question.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing, though, and that's why I emphasize UNRU. It's really up to the state, I think, now, whether or not there will be a jury trial on these types of questions. The state issued its people memorandum, and it has literally a laundry list of things that you cannot bring a claim for. And since they're in the people's memorandum and excluded, then there is sovereign immunity for those things. And the state has looked at a multitude of situations that it has decided it's not going to have these types of actions go to court.
But don't you have to get by the statute before you get to the people's memorandum? I mean, first you have to establish that this statute has somehow waived sovereign immunity.
Well, I think the statute that waives sovereign immunity, and it might be a little circular, the statute waives sovereign immunity, SDCL 2132A2, waives sovereign immunity to the extent of the people fund. And so if something is covered by the people fund coverage, then I think sovereign immunity has been waived. And that's true for ministerial acts.
Well, I thought you were suggesting that 3128.6 waived sovereign immunity for blind intersections, sharp curves, and points of danger.
I think the sovereign immunity waiver is in the people fund statutes. I think 3128.6 creates a mandatory duty that's ministerial.
That's, you're saying that is what creates the ministerial duty.
That's a mandatory duty. I mean, this state has, I mean, this court has always construed mandatory statutes as creating an obligation.
Well, let me ask you about the statute then. You know, the statute establishes those three areas where signage is supposed to be placed.
Right.
And then it says, according to uniform traffic control practices, and we've relied on this manual in our cases, and you have as well.
Yes.
And I notice from your last brief, you've attached some pages of it, and the very first page says, signs should be used only where justified by engineering judgment. And, of course, in King we said that if the act involves the exercise of professional expertise, then it's not a ministerial act. So it seems to me we're right back to involving a discretionary act here.
I think the distinction is, and it is that here in this MUTCD provision that we're relying on, and it's in the briefs, the MUTCD has drawn a picture and said, here are six types of intersections, and these are the signs that should be at these intersections. And I think it's undisputed that this is, it's on page 3 of the appendix of the blue brief. This is an acute angle intersection. I mean, I think that's just undeniable if you look at the MUTCD provision. And what acute angle intersection is something where there's the car, as the Rounds car was doing, is traveling directly into highway traffic or cross traffic. And the MUTCD actually says this is where a stop sign goes. And it says right here. And so the only way for there not to be a stop sign at that point is for the officer in charge of repair and maintenance under the statute is for that officer not to follow the MUTCD.
If I recall, that page says those are illustrations.
It says typical examples of where signs should be placed.
But then how do you respond again to the provision, the general provision of the MUTCU, whatever it is, manual? Signs should be used only where justified by engineering judgment or studies, and there's no evidence that that's occurred in this case.
Well, yeah, the MUTC, I think, was written to avoid liability, I think, and they've attempted to do that. And so they used the key phrase, the words engineering judgment. I think looking and providing a picture and saying this is where you put a stop sign, that's not the type of situation where you're calling upon particular expertise or judgment or studies. I mean, you don't have to do a study to know that this is an intersection where highway traffic is crossing. Opposing traffic is crossing at highway speeds, and that's exactly the picture that the MUTC tells you. Put a stop sign there. I mean, picture's worth 1,000 words, and it's right there. You can't look at that provision and not know that there has to be a stop sign there. I think the thing we've lost, and I want to talk about Bickner, the thing we've lost, I think, in Bickner, is the tradition, the principle, the glue that has held this court's sovereign immunity cases together is the principle that the establishment of policy is what is protected by the discretionary function. When you're talking about discretion, you're talking about policymaking discretion. And in this court's cases, from Kylo to National Bank to Wolf to King, it emphasizes time and time again that when there is a policy that is established that provides a standard that's ascertainable, as this does, then the implementation of that policy is ministerial. And I think what Bickner, and I blame it on the briefs below, because the briefs don't even cite King, they don't cite Wolf, they don't cite National Bank, they don't cite any of the cases you need to cite in these sovereign immunity cases.
Well, in the case of Schaub versus Markey in 1983, we said whether immunity is available to a governmental employee depends upon the nature of the function exercised by the employee. Is that consistent with your argument?
I think it is, and that's the first of the restatement factors, and that's my other strong concern about Bickner is, you know, the parties below didn't even discuss the restatement factors. This court has said that when you're making this determination, it's an individualized inquiry, and you have to look for a readily ascertainable standard, and then you apply these restatement factors that this court has recited for years. And it seems like courts and parties are giving lip service to these factors, seven significant factors, but then they're never discussed or applied when the analysis comes. And I think Bickner seems to say that, well, you just look for a hard and fast rule, and that it kind of it discerns it down, and I'm sure that's shorthand, I'm not trying to criticize the decision, but it leads people to believe that you just look for, if it's robotic, if it's something that is reflexive, then that's ministerial. And if it's not, then it's discretionary. And that's not how this court has ever viewed the discretionary ministerial function. It has looked at these seven factors that delve into the facts of each case. And those seem to be forgotten. And I think if we're not going to apply them, let's wipe them from our cases, because those really are what determines what is discretionary and what is not.
But you said that you're not criticizing Bickner, but actually, if we really look at it, you're asking us to retreat, or to maybe overrule Bickner.
I am. I would love to see it disappear.
And you'd also, as I read your brief, really your whole argument is really the dissent in Hansen. It looks to me.
I think the dissent in Hansen is consistent with many of this court's cases, but I think Hansen was a very carefully worded, carefully thought out decision that limited it. It talks about under these present circumstances, under these facts against this defendant, they have not shown it was a ministerial duty. So I think Hansen is in the spirit of all this court's cases, and I would blame the evidence in Hansen on what happened. But I think here the evidence is just overwhelming that there had to be a sign here, and there was a duty to put a sign here, and it's not something that takes a study to determine that when you have highway traffic shooting at each other like two bullets. I mean, if you had this in the city of Sioux Falls without a stop sign, as it was required under the statute, I would say, you'd have an accident every day. And there's been an identical accident. The state was on notice that this is happening. I mean, there's a graphic of it in our briefs.
If the state had put a sign there, do you have other claims of against the state, or does your case go away?
I think our case goes away. Our case is based on the repair and maintenance duty of erecting a sign.
All right, because in your brief you had pictures of the cut, you know, coming around the curve and some things like that. But you're just talking about signs.
Well, I think the sign is implicated in all three situations. It's implicated by the fact that there's actually a bluff there that obscures the view, so you can't see. That implicates a duty to, or at least a jury question, whether there should have been a sign there. And it's an acute angle intersection, and so the MUTCD requires a stop sign there.
Right? Did your expert say stop sign, yield sign, or what's your expert's fix for this intersection?
He said that you have to assign the right of way. There has to be signage.
In what way?
He said either a stop sign or a yield sign, I believe. His report's on the record. But you have to assign the right of way. You can't have highway traffic darting across at each other with no warning whatsoever.
Isn't there an argument that for a car going north and east, there's double lines on the road, that's also signage?
I think that's a false argument, and that's in the record. There's an exhibit in the record that tells you from the MUTCD, I believe, or from the South Dakota statutes that say all a double line tells you is you can't pass. It doesn't tell you there's traffic coming across your path that might
right.
hit you head on.
But isn't it also a recognition on the part of the State Highway Department that there's got to be signage there, but that the signage itself is not substantial enough to meet with the statute?
I think it at least shows that they know it's a problem. I definitely would agree with that.
So it's different in Bickner in the sense that there was a claim that there was a prior, that there was a sign there, but that it got knocked down or so forth. which was not believed by the circuit court, and he believed there was never a sign there in the first place.
And there was no evidence. They put
there's no evidence that there was a sign. There was just kind of an allegation.
I mean, it was almost a failure to come forward to prove your case, and I think we've certainly done that here. I guess I'll hopefully get a chance to respond in my rebuttal about talk a little more about Bickner. I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Before we start, Mr. Parsons, could I get you to move that right next to the podium? Because when you walk over there to point to it, the Internet cannot pick up your voice. Okay, thank you. And Mr. Connolly, you have 20 minutes, sir. And feel free to use the exhibit.
I too, you know, will admit that Mr. Parsons, there is some truth when he says that there is some confusion, and I think he describes it in his brief as vexing, the jurisprudence over the years, where we don't have a clear standard that permeates all areas where sovereign immunity might be a question, where the ministerial discretionary inquiry might be pertinent to the sovereign immunity question. However, I do think...
In some cases we have, and then we've backed off of it. Isn't that what he's saying?
Yes, yes. And I would say, specifically, when it comes to a question of this statute, which is SDCL 31-28-6, there has been a determination that actually, to some extent, predates some of those inquiries and some of the standards that have been put out there. Even though the People Fund wasn't an issue and wasn't put into South Dakota's statutes until, I believe, the early 1980s, we had hints of this in Jensen, which Judge Hansen, in dissent, points out what I believe is kind of a facial observation, that when you say that you have to, the statute has an intrinsic discretionary factor in it, that there has to be some kind of discretion to determine whether or not something is a sharp corner or a point of danger or a blind crossing. And I think that's exemplified by the fact that Mr. Parsons and Mr. Jenkel are asking that this be sent to a trier of fact. So we have a jury every time there is a suit, every time there is an accident, we have a jury deciding whether or not this was a sharp corner or a blind crossing or a known point of danger. And when we have that, it indicates, it runs counter to this court's jurisprudence. It says a ministerial act is something that's not up for debate, but it's something that's clear, undisputable, and you know exactly how to implement it. And I think there's a disconnect between trying to say, when you say that a jury has, that there's so many questions of fact as to whether or not this is sharp enough, or whether this is a blind enough crossing, or whether or not this was a known point of danger, and there was enough accidents there to put the state on notice. If it's so unclear that a jury has to be the determiner of that and make that determination, I don't see how you could possibly say that it's so clear that when our state officials that are charged with the important job of signing our highways open up the codified laws and look at Statute 31-28-6, that they immediately know that there needs to be a conspicuous sign at this intersection, or that they automatically know that there's a need at a sharp corner on a mountain road, or the, you know. And I think that by saying that there is a right and wrong answer at every point in our highway system as to whether or not this statute requires extraordinary signage, I think that to say there's a right answer, it just takes away the discretion, and it eliminates what I think is facially in the statute. So Mr. Parsons alluded to Bickner, and I think that the jurisprudence that surrounds this statute in particular, notwithstanding restatements, notwithstanding the inquiry into policymaking decisions as opposed to operational judgment, because that initial determination that this is a discretionary statute predates those, I don't think an inquiry into that is necessary. And even if it is, I do think that Bickner does comport with those, with the conflicting and the various different reasons and methods that we determine, that the court determines whether or not a specific statute, mandate, or policy is ministerial or discretionary.
In Bickner, we did not take into and analyze those factors that we have in a lot of the other cases.
And I don't think the court needed to, because this determination, that statute, had already, there had already been a determination before the court had ever considered the restatement's factors or ever considered some of those factors way back in Hansen. I mean, excuse me, back in Keel v. Smith County, there was a realization that in that case that even though there was a duty once a sign was put up to have a continuing duty and it was actionable as far as the upkeep of that sign was concerned, the initial decision whether or not to put up that sign is discretionary, and that predates any of those inquiries, I think.
And, you know, when you read the wording of that statute without, you know, talking about a lot of the other cases where we've dealt with it, how do you get past the shall language that the legislature has clearly directed in that statute that there be signage? I mean, it almost looks to me like a public policy statement that says we want our citizens protected and there shall be signs in these situations.
I think what the word shall and the mandatory nature of SDCL section 31-28-6 isn't that there's a master plan, that there is a cheat sheet somewhere that somebody knows where every single sign in the state goes. So to say that shall and that statute ordains where every single sign should be, I don't think that's the implication of the word shall in that statute. I think the implication of shall in the statute is that an inquiry should be made, that our officials that are charged with the important task of determining where signs are supposed to go.
Well, they specifically list, though, certain things, sharp corners and so forth.
And I think they have. I think it forces them and creates a mandatory duty that they make an inquiry, that they use their discretion to determine what is a sharp corner and what is a known point of danger and what is a blind crossing. It doesn't. In King v. Langhoof, There was the use of the word may. There was a statute that required two reflectors at a culvert and said you may use four reflectors. And this court said that doesn't create a readily ascertainable standard, that four has to be there. There's may is the discretion, indicates there's just some discretion in that law. But in Bryant v. Butte County, there also was the use of the word shall, but there was additional language. Specifically, it said that in that case, the township was required, they shall repair their roads. And Butte County decided, or the township decided, they weren't going to repair 8 bridges and they were going to push it off on another entity. And the shall there had additional language. It said that they must adequately and I forget what the other limiting word was, but there was a little bit more of exactly how they would do that task, how they would do that shall. But here, there's no indication. It doesn't say that they shall, that the person charged with signing our highways shall put a conspicuous sign when you have a corner that's more than 45 degrees.
So if the public border officer, in this case, whoever it is, decides in their discretion that they're not going to sign at all anything, you're saying that they're protected.
Well, there's two different ways I read that somebody could decide not to sign anything at all. The first case would be, you know, we already have a lot of roads in South Dakota. And if the person in charge went out or went across their township or went across all the way down Highway 14 from the Minnesota border to the Wyoming border and said, I'm going to take down all these signs, then I don't think they would be off the hook, because the cases that Mr. Parsons alluded to, specifically Braun v. No Hope Township and Fritz v. Howard Township, where there is where the court did recognize that sometimes, even when you have a question concerning SDCL 31-28-6, there is questions of fact. It's always when you've recognized, you've used your discretion to say that there should be a sign, then you have an ongoing duty. And that duty traces back all the way back to Jensen and Keel, saying that you have an ongoing duty to upkeep that sign once you've recognized it. So, Justice Meyer-Henry, I think if that's the process by which the person in charge decided that they weren't going to sign the roads, by removing the signs that were already there, then I think they wouldn't be off the hook because they would still be covered by that provision, and they'd already recognized that it was there and they had an ongoing duty, and they would have, you'd have to examine the question of fact.
So how do you get there from this language to that conclusion? When it says shall erect and maintain, it doesn't say shall if you decided to do it first and then you have to maintain it once you've decided it. It doesn't say that in this statute.
Well, I think the acknowledgement that once you recognize it and you have a duty to continue, it comes from the case law. I think it comes from Fritz and it comes from Braun. That once you recognize, and it isn't in the statute, but...
Well, how do you respond to counsel's argument that the illustrative drawing does, in fact, create a non-discretionary standard?
I don't agree with the... And you're saying applying the
drawing that counsel had in his
supplemental brief.
The national standards show, give an illustration... of instances where there should be a stop sign, and this intersection we're dealing with.
And I addressed this in my brief, that I don't think that this particular illustration is representative of what is going on here. Basically, if you look at that illustration, he's saying there should be a stop sign here. And I'm assuming by looking at figure 2A-2, and I'm on appendix 3 of what you just referred to of Exhibit 5, so this would be the third page of Exhibit 5. That stop sign in this example is where you have one road intersecting with another road, and that's the only intersection you have between those two trunk highways. But here, you don't have somebody that, if they came to this part, if you had a stop sign there, which I assume would be meant to control traffic making a right-hand turn, nobody would ever come down here, make a right-hand turn to continue up here to Eagle Butte. They would have merged off that here. It's a different intersection. I don't think that...
Well, so one or the other would have to stop or yield or something because they are bound to cross if they happen to get there at the same time.
Why, just because there's a stop sign there, why would they go west instead of south when they want to go south?
I'm saying... Well, yes. In this example in Appendix 5, part of the reason there was a stop sign at that type of intersection is to control people that would be turning left, which would be continuing on 14 south, to make an analogy. But you don't have a situation where people are making both left-hand or right-hand turns. Nobody's ever going to make a right-hand turn coming on 14 to go up 63 to get over 34.
Oh, so you think that stop sign is only to control a right-hand turn?
In the example? Or there's not a stop sign here?
No, but had there been?
Yeah, and I think it was partially to control the right-hand turn and partially to control the left-hand turn. I think
wouldn't it also operate like a yield sign so they didn't run headlong? They'd reduce the speed, and they wouldn't run headlong at highway speed into somebody else going north?
Well, I don't think that that's what it could serve as a yield sign. Stop is, in and of it, I mean, I guess intrinsic in that is that you're yielding. But none of the examples he provides has a yield sign in that particular configuration. The other example, a channelized intersection, would have the yield sign here, facing this way, which wouldn't have done anything to control the traffic because people, the alleged point of conflict is because you have people continuing straight across this fellow yellow line. So putting a yield sign there, wouldn't accomplish anything. And I think that,
Do you agree that this is a dangerous situation here?
I would say that it's not ideal.
So if, let's say, I mean, and there have been other accidents, and this is a dangerous situation, is it still discretionary when they're, when you, I mean, you can look at this and see it's a dangerous situation, and there have, and they were aware of it. Is that still discretionary? I mean, at some point, doesn't it become ridiculous? I mean...
But I don't think there's a clear indication at what point. I mean, it's
can they just look? Can they just turn their head and say, "Well, it's our discretion, and we're not going to put one there, no matter how dangerous it is."
I think to the extent that that's what the case law says for this particular statute, and that's the, that's why we have sovereign immunity, and that's why we have, you know, smart people and people that we trust in those positions. And I don't think that. That one similar accident at this intersection necessarily points out that there was a
that might be a question for the jury. But isn't that kind of why they put this statute in here, or the legislature did, is to say, hey, you can't just ignore points of danger; you need to sign them. I mean, if you had a road that ran off a cliff,
well definitely,
you know, you got to go put a sign there. Isn't that what they're saying?
I don't think they're saying. But you have to put a sign, because that would contemplate that it's ordained where every sign would be. I think it mandates that they have to use their judgment and make a decision using their discretion to determine whether or not those factors existed. And to the extent the legislature didn't put in a guide or any way that they would come to a determination whether or not a corner is sharp enough or crossing is blind enough, I don't think that you can somehow say that they just lose discretion because, you know, we think that this looks dangerous. And, I mean, using that logic, it would get to the point, possibly, like Justice Konenkamp said, where we would have, does every accident create a known point of danger every time you've had an accident in the past?
We're talking about this particular situation. We're not talking about every. I mean, I think then it comes down to the facts of the case.
And if it does come down to the facts of the case, who decides, you know, who decides the question? You guys have battled in your briefs. Is it a question of law or a question of fact? Should it go to the jury? Who decides this question of fact that Justice Meyer Henry just brought up under our cases?
Well, I think to the extent that if a particular statute or guideline or directive was deemed to be ministerial and not to invoke sovereign immunity, then because it's a question of fact concerning duty and breach and, you know, the elements of whatever negligent or tort action is brought, then obviously the trier of fact, the jury, would have to determine the validity of those material facts. However, I think the court's jurisprudence is pretty clear that we need to protect, and there's reasons. If you look to the restatements and you look to all of the different standards the court has put out there, we want to protect the people that sign our roads and the people that have jobs that would entail discretion. And to that extent, you know, it's a matter of law, and the justices are charged, and our circuit court judges are charged with looking at the facts and I guess turning away, because it's not really an issue whether or not this is a sharp corner, whether or not it is a blind crossing, because this court has already said that this statute imposes a discretionary duty. So I don't think you would even... I don't think that question of fact has to be resolved in this case, whether or not it is a known point of danger, whether or not it's a sharp corner.
Let's direct our attention for a minute to the double lines that appear on the highway as you go northeast. Do you recognize that, or do you acknowledge that the State Highway Patrol recognize that as highway signage when they put those double lines on the road, so that for cars going straight north, they would, you know, they can't cross those double lines?
Yes, typically when you even if it's a non-double yellow line, you have a duty to if you're going to pass, to do that with care, and if you're going to cross into the other lane, you have a duty to.
All right. So there's a recognition there on the highway department that's a point of danger or whatever under the statute. My next question is Do you consider that a substantial and conspicuous warning sign?
And I don't know. I don't know how to answer that because the legislature has not told us what a substantial and conspicuous warning sign is.
Those pretty plain words, aren't they? They're words people, laymen, use all the time. We know what a warning sign is. Do you know what conspicuous is? Do you know what substantial means? Something more than half? Okay.
Indeed, then.
Isn't that exactly what the MTUCD manual specifies? That manual is very specific with respect to the sign, the size of the sign, and what should be on it, and that type of thing.
Yes.
So if it were a case that involved something in violation of this manual, you wouldn't have a disagreement. As far as the adequacy of the sign, if it doesn't comply with the manual, then there would be liability.
I don't think that the appellants have pointed to a specific provision of the MUTC that would say what sign is needed here.
You know, it may be several. Don't you think it might be a stop sign to prevent traffic going northeast or going straight north? Maybe a stop sign for people going south on that road?
It may be any number of things, but
But can we leave it up to the absolute discretion of somebody? It doesn't seem like it seems to me like it's a ministerial duty that you only have to look at that intersection and it tells you that there ought to be some substantial and conspicuous warning sign there. Maybe for traffic going both ways.
And perhaps that is true, but I notice I'm out of time, Your Honor, but
you can answer my question.
Again, I would reiterate that I think that we still, it's as important to protect the sovereignty of the state of South Dakota and the workers and to not have them believe that every decision they make is going to be second-guessed, because I think, as it said in Hansen, that would create a chilling effect on the performance of their duties.
Thank you. Your time has expired. Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Zinner, I wanted to go to your question. Who decides that issue? And in Wolf versus Sense, which was an opinion that you joined and was unanimous on the specific holding, this court said that it can be a jury question. Now, the mandatory policy in Wolf was that you have to do sanding at specific times. You shall sand unless there is traffic is moving safely or conditions are hazardous. And so the policy set forth a mandatory standard, readily ascertainable, as this court held unanimously. And the worker then uses his operational judgment to determine, are conditions too hazardous for me to sand? Is traffic moving safely enough for me to sand? And so even though there's operational judgment exercised by the person charged with the mandatory duty, this court held it was a jury question on the issue of sovereign immunity.
That's a really interesting question, because we really spoke of two fact-finding decisions in that case.
Yes.
We remanded on the fact question to determine whether or not the ice, sand, snow removal policy was violated. Wasn't that the question of fact we remanded on? But we also said in that case that the issue of sovereign immunity is a question of law which is reviewed by the Supreme Court de novo.
It is. Like any question of law, though, a question of law, if the facts are in dispute, then the facts are decided. And I would suggest that's precisely what we have here, at least.
So that's the dilemma for me in this situation. If we have a dispute of fact about whether this is a sharp angle or a dangerous point, do we decide the initial question of duty and sovereign immunity and then let a jury decide? If we would say yes, then a jury would decide, did the officials violate that duty by not putting the right kind of sign at this intersection?
I think if the facts are disputed, I think it's a jury question. And it's a affirmative defense. Remember.
Both questions? The initial question as to sovereign immunity.
Well, if the sovereign immunity question can't be resolved because the facts are disputed, then I think you have to let the jury decide the facts.
See, and that's what's so important here because, as Justice Konenkamp said earlier, should we be letting juries throughout South Dakota decide the sovereign immunity question?
But they're not deciding the sovereign immunity question. They're deciding whether it was a point of danger. And that's the same as in Wolf. They're deciding whether conditions are too dangerous.
But then doesn't that change the standard? I mean, we have to look at a legal standard. The MUCTD gives us a standard. We can look at that and we can say, okay, it says such and such for this. Everyone can look at that ahead of time and say there's a violation of the standard. But do we have a problem when we have the jury saying in one county, well, this curve is sharp, and a jury in another county saying, well, the same curve with the same angle is not a sharp curve?
I think that's possible, but the evidence would determine. And I think that's true with every determination that's made, you know, in courts of law. The evidence is what should control. If I quickly...
But isn't that then just an abrogation of sovereign immunity and you're down to a question of negligence?
I don't think it's an abrogation of sovereign immunity, and I think this is the critical point. The legislature has complete control over this. I mean, you heard Mr. Connolly rewriting the statute before your very eyes. They have passed a mandatory statute. You shall put up a stop sign or a sign substantial and conspicuous at these situations when these standards exist. You have to do that. Now, they want you to read that as saying, well, you have to do that if you decide that maybe you should. The legislature, if it doesn't want liability in these types of situations, it can alter the statute and say that this duty is not mandatory, it's discretionary. End of story. There's no more cases. It could also go to the People Fund Memorandum and say, excluded from liability are cases arising under 3128.6. End of story. And I think this court should follow the plain language of the statute and should not be attempting to broaden sovereign immunity where we can assume the legislature has chosen not to. I mean, I think the legislature's silence, it knows about these cases. It knows about Fritz. It knows about Braun. Its silence has to be accorded meaning here.
What about the phrase, in accordance with uniform traffic practices? You didn't mention that, and it says, shall, sharp curves, points of danger, and then it says, in accordance with. So doesn't that limit everything that's before it?
Well, I think that is reasonably construed as meaning the signage has to, you know, in terms of shape, size, conspicuousness, placement, you know, that has to conform. But here, again, this case is so different from Bickner because we do have the exact, I mean, you know, you hear the phrase, do I have to paint a picture for you? They painted a picture for the person and just, the stop sign goes here. And that's a huge difference with Bickner. I also think that these restatement factors, if we shift it to a test that Bickner seems to suggest, is it just a hard and fast rule? Is it just a mindless, robotic type of response? The restatement factors are not, they're being tossed out the window. And those factors are so important because they go into really the essence of why we have sovereign immunity. And I think the critical one is the extent to which passing judgment on the exercise of discretion by the officer will amount necessarily to passing judgment by the court on the conduct of a coordinate branch of government. And here the legislature has already established the standard. So all you're doing is enforcing the standard that the legislature has already selected. It also talks about the extent to which imposition of liability would impair the free exercise of discretion. Well, the statute doesn't allow for discretion. They could rewrite it if they wanted to make it discretionary, but this court has interpreted shall as obligatory. So you have to ascertain facts. You have to use judgment. But in terms of discretion, there is none in the statute. It talks about the extent to which ultimate financial responsibility would fall on the officer. Well, not at all here, because the People Fund covers this if it's a ministerial duty. It talks about the likelihood that harm will result to members of the public if the action is taken. None at all. In fact, if the statute is enforced, as the legislature has commanded, then lives are saved, injuries are prevented. It talks about the nature and seriousness of the type of harm that may be produced. This is the most serious type of harm imaginable. I mean, this is a case with three deaths, and a prior case where people very well could have died. And the record is filled with testimony from residents about near misses and how this is infamous. And the sheriff has testified in his deposition, and he knows, he gets reports of near misses happening all the time. People pull over to the side of the road and have to catch their breath because they're terrified that they just almost hit a car they had no idea was about to plow right into them. These are things, the facts matter when you make these types of determinations. I mean, that's why this court adopted the restatement many years ago. And it seems like, I mean, the trial court in this case didn't even mention the restatement. The parties in Bickner didn't mention the restatement. The Bickner decision, understandably, therefore, didn't mention the restatement. I mean, the restatement and the fact that there's a readily ascertainable standard is controlling, I think, in this case. And I think this court needs to step back and decide this and let's create a workable, neutral standard that can be applied. So I do think we have to distinguish Bickner at least and revisit some of these other cases. And if we're going to read this shall statute as discretionary, then let's just eliminate all these cases and we won't bring them anymore. But I think that's a legislative determination. I think the legislature could do that tomorrow if they convene a special session. They could do it next March. I think this court has to apply the plain language of the statutes and be consistent with the spirit of the true spirit of the discretionary ministerial dichotomy. I really know this court is focused on this case, and I thank the court for the serious attention that it's giving it, and I appreciate the opportunity for oral argument.
Thank you, Mr. Persons. We'll be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
But